Good morning. Members, Representative Hertz, we're actually going to do in your first. So you can go ahead there. Members, I'd like to move House File 3310 to, you know what, Representative Hertz, excuse me. Representative Fabian, will you move the minutes of yesterday, April 5th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are adopted. Excuse me, Representative Hertz. Representative Hertz has House File 3310 that will be laid over. Representative Hertz, you have a DE3 amendment that I would like to move. Discussion to the DE3 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The DE3 is adopted. Representative Hertz, I am going to keep my composure as much as possible here. You are doing phase three of what I have done phase one when, unfortunately, my brother-in-law died at our lake cabin in 1999 after I came to the legislature. We passed the carbon monoxide bill, and unfortunately, we never had carbon monoxide detectors. We had them everywhere, but at our lake home, lake cabin, it was my mother-in-law's cabin, and unfortunate accident, but we were able to pass a law that get carbon monoxide detectors required, and then a few years later we expanded that to include some fish houses and stuff, and we're now learning, unfortunately, some of our lake boats, real unfortunate sad story that we heard in mining. So Representative Hertz, we moved your DE3 amendment, and I don't know what you want to add, but welcome to the committee and go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, members. Yeah, ironically, after I presented this bill in another committee, I came home that evening. My wife said to me, "Do you have a monoxide detector at the hunt shack?" I said, "No. Come to think of it, I don't. Maybe we should." Well, members, Sophia's Law is a proposal to make sure that carbon monoxide detection systems are aboard watercraft vessels that are enclosed. And the definition of an enclosed watercraft requires that there be a designated sleeping accommodation, that it also has a galley area with a sink, and it also has a head compartment. So it would only apply to those vessels 16 feet and longer that would meet those criteria of an enclosure. Imagine, if you would, on a nice bright fall summer day, that you're out on the lake and enjoying the fall color with your family, and you're on the water, and maybe one of your family members, in this case a small child, complains of a headache, and rather unknowingly the advice is to maybe go down in the cuddy and lay down for a little bit, maybe you'll feel better, only to find out that very compartment that the child was playing in had carbon monoxide present. And as you may know, carbon monoxide is an odorless, colorless, poisonous gas that basically, when absorbed into the body, inhibits the body's bloodstream to bond with iron and oxygen to oxygenate your body, and causes severe problems, if not death, if levels are attained, and particularly with small children with small body mass, that is more easily obtained than in an adult. So what the bill proposes to do is require these types of monoxide detectors on new watercraft, and then with licensed dealers, if they're conveying to a new owner, that they would retrofit those vessels, and for the non-complying ones, that the DNR provide safety warning materials or labeling stickers that can be affixed to the hull of the boat, particularly where you enter the watercraft, just as a warning. I think I've got somebody from the DNR here.
Yeah, Representative Hertz, I believe Mr. Strage, I'm sorry, I don't know if we pronounced it on the end or not, is going to come forward with DNR
sure. And
testify. And
I was told Mr. Myers here, but this will be fine.
We get the guy that knows what's going on. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Thank you. I'm Stan Linnell, the State Boating Law Administrator with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Bob Meyer is on his way. He may have further comments if we're still on this topic.
Excuse me, sir. I'm going to ask you to repeat your name because we had
not
the wrong testifier. So if you could.
Yes.
I definitely called you out wrong by name. And Assistant Commissioner Meyer is here. But if you're the one that knows, we'd rather have you here. No
I've been working closely together with Bob Meyer. My name again is Stan Linnell. I'm with the Division of Parks and Trails in the Department of Natural Resources. I've been working together with Bob Meyer and the representative and the senators on this bill. And we had a recent conversation with industry, the American Boat Yacht Council, to discuss their interest in this bill and what was feasible and possible for industry to accommodate in quick order. So we've made some changes to the bill to make it accommodate the possibilities of what can be done in manufacturing in a short order, while also addressing a broader nature. We noticed not a lot of the boats in Minnesota have all three of those things, although that was certainly the case in the recent incident where we lost poor Sophia. What we've done is we've required labeling that will be sent out to boat owners of 19-foot and larger boats, and they will be required to have it if they have just any type of enclosure intended for human occupancy. They'll at least have to have a warning label. There's a lot of boats out there that would be expensive to retrofit, the smaller boats that just have a cuddy cabin, so we'll at least require the warning label so people will be aware of the danger. People can choose to add carbon monoxide detectors if they so choose on those boats. And currently there's not a portable detector that's marine certified, and we hope that there will be one within a year. It should make it much easier for boat owners to accommodate that interest. So this report now also requires a report back to the legislature by November of 2018 to address how this bill has been implemented, changes in industry standards, and possible other areas that we could incorporate into the law if so needed.
Questions for Mr. Linnell? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that trying to do more would be very expensive. What are you talking about in terms of expense?
Mr. Linnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark. But right now, again, boats of that have the three requirements of a head, a sleeping accommodation, and a galley currently are required all new boats to add or have carbon monoxide detectors when they're built. This bill would also require, if you have an existing boat with those three things, to add a carbon monoxide detector, which would be some number of thousands of boats in Minnesota, which would be a big effort of the marine industry and repair shops to get those all installed. Beyond that, we have boats all the way down to 17 or 18 feet that might have a small little cuddy area. None of those areas might not be set up for electricity, so it would be in the tens of thousands of boats that potentially would need to be rewired if we were to immediately require all boats to have carbon monoxide detectors at this point. And manufacturers aren't set up for those small boats in having carbon monoxide detectors in the time frame that was originally spelled out, which was by implementing by May of 17.
Representative Clark.
Let's follow up. So I believe there are carbon monoxide detectors that are battery operated, isn't that correct?
Mr. Linnell.
Yes, there are. Representative Clark, there are battery operated ones. Those are not marine certified. Yeah. So they would not meet the standard of the American Boat and Yacht Council to be appropriate for use in a boat. A lot of electronic appliances that you use in your home are not suitable for use in boats. The different wiring standards that are required for marine boats.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to understand in the interest of the children, but not just the children, because we have adults who are being poisoned by carbon monoxide too, I'm sure, in some of these situations, and may not even make the connection, that a headache or something is caused by that. But I'm just wondering what it would take to, I don't know what the cost is. I know I've just carbon monoxide detectors for my home. It doesn't seem like it's very costly, even the battery-operated ones. And I'm just wondering if you've looked into at least until it gets to the point of actually doing the wiring, if there wouldn't be a benefit from at least having a battery-operated carbon monoxide detector. What do you think? You've done the work on this. I don't know. It just seems to me it might be helpful.
Representative Hertog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, as a member of the building community, the residential carbon monoxide detectors are available readily in the marketplace now, ranging anywhere from $17 to $25. Some of them offer a few more services, and you can spend $25 or $30. But you're correct. Currently, in the residential housing market, for fish houses and homes and different enclosed areas, you can buy those. They are battery operated. They're adhesive. They can just simply be applied to the ceiling. And one of the things that came about as a result of this legislation is there's been some public input about the levels of detection on with regard to the current home monoxide detectors that are on the market have a higher level of parts per million that are necessary to detect before the alarm goes off. And there was some concern that that the detectors need to have a more sensitive reading with regard to these smaller areas and with smaller children. And so a conversation did ensue as a result of this legislation with the industry and the marine certified detectors, and it's a consensus that change in detection can be met in terms of the design criteria. So that was the direction they're going, and basically the current ones have detect about 70 carbon monoxide parts per million, and the goal with the amendments was to lower that to about half of that level.
Representative Clark.
Okay, well, it sounds like the industry is looking at it, and I'm just... The warning labels, I do have a question about that, Mr. Chairman. So the warning labels are on the boat when they are sold. Is that correct?
Representative Hertzog.
I'm sorry.
The warning labels are on the boat when they're sold. Is that sold by a dealer or sold
by a dealer? Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the intention is to have the DNR create a label warning product that can be affixed with the licensure of the boats as part of just like getting a sticker with your license tabs, that you can apply these warning labels to the hull of certain boats that meet the requirements of having to have that, and also to prepare a report to the legislature on the effects of.
Thank you. Just one final question,
Clark.
Mr. Chairman. Are these labels are, I assume, in English at this point? Has there been any effort to think about having them in multiple languages? We have a lot of fisher people. A lot of people fish from our new American communities who don't. That's not their first language that they speak or read.
Representative Hertzog, Mr. Linnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark. Yes, I mean, the current stickers that the American Yacht and Boat Council and NMMA use are actually graphic stickers, so that they're hopefully understandable by people with others, although it's the CO is, you know, used as the symbol for something, a gas that you can't see. So currently it is in more graphic standards for international use.
Representative Clark.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hertzog, comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that Mr. Meyer has arrived. Did you want to speak on Sophia's Law? No? Okay. And then is Mr. Stieg here?
Thank you. If you could come forward and identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Ray Strege. My wife suffered carbon monoxide poisoning our boat's cabin in 2010. The boat had a residential non-marine carbon monoxide detector. After we had been underway for about 30 minutes, my wife came up from the cabin and said that she had the worst headache of her life, and that it seemed as though her brain was had expanded and it was too big for her head. Our carbon monoxide detector never sounded. She leaned as far over the boat rail as possible to inhale fresh air for several minutes. My wife mentioned that there were numbers on the detector. Our carbon monoxide detector had a digital display and showed a carbon monoxide concentration readout of 70 parts per million. This was the first time since we had installed the detector that numbers were shown. Previously, it only displayed dashes, which indicated that there was less than 30 parts per million. There are currently, as mentioned, there are currently no marine detectors as required by House File 3310 on the market with digital displays. They only have audible alarms. At 70 parts per million, a marine detector meeting Underwriter Laboratory standards as required by this bill would not have activated the alarm until the concentration had existed for 1 to 4 hours. In my wife's situation, she thought she had carbon monoxide poisoning, but I might not have suspected such poisoning because I felt no illness myself. The 70 parts per million digital readout indicated that sufficient levels might be present and that we needed to take corrective action. Boaters need a better marine carbon monoxide detector than is currently available that will give them an early warning of potential danger rather than delaying the alarm until emergency exists. Amendment Section 5, the report, points us in the correct direction. I support this amendment with the caveat that the legislature, regulatory agencies, and industry commit to a long-term, persistent pursuit of a better carbon monoxide detector, one that alerts boat occupants to elevated carbon monoxide levels before they become emergencies. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? I don't see any. Thank you for your testimony. That helps clear up some of Representative Clark's questions. Mr. Linnell, I have a couple questions, or Commissioner Meyer, Representative Purcell? Sorry, Representative Purcell.
Thank you. Just briefly, and I don't know if this would be for, I'll just throw it out there perhaps Mr. Meyer know the answer to it, but on the subdivision 2 of the bail boating safety courses, my question was about, is there going to be some safety information put out there? So the boating safety courses, what part of the population is getting boating safety courses in this information that is going to be out there? How many people is this going to get to? That's my question.
Mr. Linnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Currently, we have a youth voting requirement for mandatory education. So youth up to between 12 and 18 and 17 years old are required to take a boat operator's course before operating a motorboat over 25 horsepower. So we've had that in place for many, many years. So a lot of people have had this course, and this is actually carbon monoxide detection, carbon monoxide information has been part of the safety course for a number of years. I don't have that exact figure, but it is part of a requirement of all courses.
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think there's a lot of folks that are of my generation that never had a boating safety course. And I mean, that might be the majority of boaters out there at this time, being the baby boomers, eh? It just seems like there could be a little more effort on that, getting information. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, boy, don't we know about this already? And evidently not. I mean, there's not enough information out there, obviously.
Thank you for those comments. Chairman, just on that, Commissioner Meyer.
The Boat Water Safety
Course. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The Boat Water Safety Course isn't mandatory, as Mr. Linnell said. Only if you're that age bracket using a motor over 25 horsepower. There has been interest, and hopefully someday we can make it so it is required to operate boats, such as an ATV certificate or a snowmobile safety certificate or a firearm safety certificate, and bring in a lot more education on AIS, carbon monoxide, and those types of things. So hopefully we can talk about that at some point in time.
Commissioner Meyer, any other questions? Commissioner Meyer, I have a couple questions. Do we have an active database of marine operators that will be putting the boats in the lakes this spring? Specifically, I'm wondering, do we have an opportunity to reach out to, especially on the bigger lakes where the enclosed cabins are, and is there an opportunity for us to immediately reach out to them with some of the information that's available so these people can offer this service immediately? I'm wondering if we have that. Do you know, or do you want to get back to me if that data is available? Because don't we, through AIS or something,
Mr.
potentially
Chairman,
know these people?
through a lake service provider training and registration. I believe that data is available. Let me just clarify what's in that database that we could sort it out by the larger marinas. Or if it's important enough information, we could try to send it out to all of those lake service providers.
Yeah, and maybe, Commissioner Meyer, especially if there's a way to crisscross that, and if they do something else that we regulate. I'm thinking especially on the bigger lakes where these cabins, enclosed cabins, and on the St. Croix and Mississippi where they all are, if we have an opportunity to reach out to them immediately with some written and electronic information about, because they can retrofit these existing ones and get those warnings out potentially. I mean, you should take your time to develop, but I think there might be an opportunity to reach these folks right away. And then I would hope that you'll use it as a opportunity when you talked about the fishing opener and AIS. Maybe we can add the importance of the carbon monoxide detectors. Because, Mr. Linnell, I've got a question. I know Representative Hertaus's bill is reaching out to the people that fit in that parameters of going down in the cuddy and those things. But what about if you're on an open bow boat that some of the open bow boats where you can enclose the front off, and then I'm thinking of when our kids were young, we used to lay them down, what I would call the passenger seat of the boat, and put them down on the floor, down at the feet of the passenger person, and where I'm sure there would be some circulation of air potential there. Has there been examples that you're aware of where somebody hasn't been in a cuddy, but they've been laying? And then even what about, I know it's illegal to lay way on the top in the back, but there's some boats that have a spot where you can lay across the back. And is there a potential where the circulation from the engine compartment, I'm curious to know, can that happen? And that would just be an education thing. I don't know how you could possibly put a detector there, because that would matter whether the boat's moving or stopping or whatever. Mr. Linnell.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you are correct. There is a CO detection or CO problem with the, often called the station wagon effect, where you have a boat that has partial enclosure especially. Can't even happen out on the open depending on wind conditions, conditions of the boat motor, how well it's running. We did have an incident a couple years ago on Lake of the Woods where there was a three-sided enclosed hard shell boat, defective exhaust that was poorly fixed. Where two individuals did die, a third did survive that. So there is risk in, you know, that wouldn't be covered by this law as far as the carbon monoxide detectors, because again, they wouldn't necessarily be effective. And it, the more open the boat, the less chance it has of being effective. We do require a warning label on any boat that does have an enclosed compartment, and that's a lesser standard. So if they just had an enclosed head or just had a small enclosed cuddy, they would have to have the warning stickers. And in addition, we'll be mailing information to all boat owners of boats 19 feet and greater that will include the stickers. So even if they're not required to have them, they can choose to install the stickers, and they will also be getting information on carbon monoxide. So that will be addressing a vast majority of the larger boats that tend to have those enclosures.
Mr. Linnell, I'm thinking, and Mr. Strage's comments brought me back to, at our hunting cabin, we have a digital CO detector, because there's some carbon monoxide appliances in, especially in cabins, there can be an LP refrigerator that can put off carbon monoxide. A gas stove puts off carbon monoxide, and if you especially today when we're building stuff more airtight, and I know those digital numbers can show up as Mr. Strage noted. Usually they're zeros, but once in a while you can get numbers to pop up. And it's not at a detectable or not at a, where the warning will go off, but it can tell you. So would the marine CO detectors have a numeric number on them, either Mr. Linnell or Representative Hertaus? So the ones that are available currently that you are electric, do they come with the digital? I know the audible would go off at a number, but do they have a digital display, some of them at least?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that there are digital display CO detectors in the marketplace. With regard to the marine ones, it appears that the standards that we've amended the law, that they don't have some of these available as yet, but this would, in working with DNR and with the industry, it appears that there's a peace agreement that they can come up with. They have the technology to be able to do that.
Well, Representative Hertzog, the challenge you have is you're on the cutting edge trying to deal with a problem, and we don't have the technology to help us. And sadly, it may be an education effort that's the most important thing at this immediate time. And I'm wondering if we'll be able to, Commissioner Meyer, make sure that COs have some of stickers and stuff, so when they go up to a cutty, you know, a cruiser on the big lakes and say, you know, you should be aware of this new effort and just something. I'm hoping that we're thinking of that. Commissioner Meyer, I do have a couple other questions, but Commissioner Meyer, to that point.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources again. That will be one of our major efforts as we're working on the major lakes, the bigger lakes, to educate people and provide them the stickers and information at that point in time so they can get ahead of the curve.
Thank you, Commissioner Meyer. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an extremely tragic, horrific situation, and I appreciate that you're bringing forward this bill. I'm just wondering, since the family seems inclined to say it can be Sophia's Law, and as the chair has indicated, you know, putting some notice out, I mean, certainly if it's referred to as Sophia's Law, and if you could maybe have her image, or if you would have something as a part of every, you know, boat dock on the larger lakes anyway, I would think that people would be more inclined to consider what the consequences are, rather than just the written language about what a bill is, you know, the statute being this and this and this. So, again, thank you for bringing this bill. I appreciate hearing this certainly tragic and unfortunate situation, but the outcome perhaps would be that other lives are saved. So thank you.
And Representative Poppy, in Chair Hackbart's committee, we heard moving testimony from Sophia's father. Both really sad story. Both he and his wife are doctors. His wife, if I'm not mistaken, is a cardiologist. And to hear their moving testimony, and Representative Hertzog had conversations with the family, and they have testified both in the Senate and the House once, and they did not feel a need to come forward and testify again. But it was extremely moving testimony, and I would certainly be our hope to leave her name attached to the bill and hope that in the future it could help in its effectiveness. So, Representative Hertzog, seeing no more further comments, if you want to give the closing comment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the questions that you asked. This really is an educational campaign to get the information out. And this incident happened in my district on Lake Minnetonka, which many of you are probably aware are many of these types of vessels and watercraft, not to mention places like Marine, St. Croix, or on Lake Superior, or Lake Vermilion, and some of the larger water bodies. And we have many of these service providers all around my district that these boats are sitting in storage with the blue wrap on them right now, but they'll be hitting the water in the next few weeks. And if the DNR is capable of at least even an email message to these providers, just warning them of the risks and to advise their clients and customers about it, and maybe for those that do have systems in place, they can, as part of their winterization and their spring service, can make sure that some of these things are functioning and have a proper test. But thank you for hearing the bill, and thank you, members. Look forward to making a difference for the Backler family and anyone else. We heard one testimony today where somebody was saved and did make a difference, and nobody will be able to ever change the decisions that a parent made at that moment, and the unimaginable feelings and emotions of having to live with this the rest of your life in terms of advising your child to go down and lay down in a cuddy for a while. That's a burden that certainly has compelled the Backler family to want to make sure nobody else goes through what they're going through. Thank you.
And I remind members that some of the, I see Sophia's mother's testimony that was given in the Senate is in our packet, and her father gave similar testimony in Representative Hackbart's committee. The bill's laid over. Thank you, members. Next, Representative Torkelson, I think you are going to do House File 3000, which is Buffer Bill 2, I believe. Actually, maybe it's just Buffer Bill 1 clarification. And I don't know, are you on your own here, or what's the plan? Representative Torkelson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3000 be amended with the DE1. The motion is that once amended, it be passed to the General Register.
Representative Torkelson moves the DE3 amendment to get the bill, to the shape you'd like. Discussion to the DE3. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Torkelson, the DE3 is the tax provision removed from the bill with the DE3 amendment.
Representative Torkelson.
There is no tax provision in the DE3. I don't think we ever had the tax provision before this committee, actually.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe that's the Senate where there's still
that's
a tax
correct.
Provision.
The Senate had the tax provision. We have never incorporated that into our Bill 3000.
Representative Hansen.
Chair, and I think that's a good thing.
Further discussion to the DE3 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The DE3 is adopted. Representative Torkelson, why don't you walk us through the House File 3000 as amended by your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I would just go through the changes between House File 3000 as we heard it amended in the last committee meeting and as it's being amended in the DE3. So starting out on the first page, that whole section from 1.1 all the way through to 2.10 mostly deals with the APO authority that's being used for enforcement. It just makes it clear that we're using Bowser's APO authority, which normally is up to $10,000, but in this case, for the buffers, it's going to be limited to $500. And this language makes that absolutely crystal clear. And then also on page 2, this paragraph beginning on line 2.4 indicates to Bowser that they need to put a plan together for how the APO authority is to be administered, so it's clear to the counties and watershed districts that choose to take this jurisdiction just how it is to be used. Moving on page 2 down to lines 2.1 to 2.25, this just clarifies that if a buffer is put in place before compensation occurs, that once compensation happens, they will go back to the value of the land as it was before a buffer was installed. So that protects the landowner's interest in the value of the land that may go into a buffer. Moving on then to page 3, this clearly restricts us to the public waters inventory that we've talked about a lot, that the 50-foot buffers are only on the public waters inventory that is already part of statute. Much of the language in this DE deals with jurisdiction, and on line 3.15 to 3.18, what really needs to happen is counties and watershed districts need to accept jurisdiction. If they do not take on this role of jurisdiction, it reverts back to Bowser, and this language clarifies that. Moving on to near the bottom of page 3, there's been some talk about how buffers are measured, and we're going to refer to existing law. There was a lot of discussion a few years ago about how buffers are to be measured. We're not trying to change that. We're using existing law. And the language on 3.33 just clarifies that buffer installation should not interfere with future ditch maintenance. On page 4, on line 4.5, we had some questions in committee last time about these additional practices with retention ponds. This language on 4.5 clarifies that these practices are to be additional. They're to be included with the other practices that are already available, and it's not a requirement. Again, on line 4.9 and 4.10, This again refers to that language about measuring buffers, and we're using the existing process. Moving on to line 4.20 to 4.22, this language is to clearly indicate that our intent is not to interfere with any other federal or state conservation programs, so that landowners will be eligible. It's our intent that landowners be eligible to enroll and or re-enroll in either state or federal conservation programs such as CRP. Next, moving on to subdivision 4, starting along 4.25. This deals with the planning process. We didn't want to force water authorities to have to do an updated plan, so this language allows them to incorporate new information regarding buffers into their plan using an addendum instead of a new plan. Moving on to page 5, on line 5.4, then it clarifies that they can do this updating as part of their regular scheduled update instead of having to do it as a special plan. Next section, section 7, starting in subdivision 7, deals with the APO authority and how it is to be administered, assuming that when a local jurisdiction takes on this authority, how the corrective actions are utilized. And that whole, all the language in there deals with that, I believe. Finally, moving on to page 6, on line 6.16 to 6.21, this language clarifies that funds to be withheld are only the Board of Water and Soil Resources funds. Non-compliance by a county would not result in any other funds being withheld, so there was some nervousness about the language as it stood before. And finally, the last part of the page, we have a chance here to finally eliminate some words that have been problematic. If you look on line 6.31, we see the benefited area term has been crossed out, much to my pleasure.
Representative Carlson, much to your what?
Pleasure. I'm happy that it's gone away.
Thank you.
It caused us some headaches, as you may remember, over the interim.
I wanted to forget. Representative Carlson.
I'm done, Mr. Chair. I'm ready to stand for questions.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Carlson from members. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Line 527 to 528, when the county is adopting the plan, and it has to be consistent with the plan adopted by the board, how much leeway do they have there?
Representative Tarkles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The plan that's being referred to in this section is the plan to administer the APO. I believe I have that correct, but perhaps Mr. Harnack might be able to fill me in a little more detail.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Harnack. Identify yourself for the record. Did you hear the question?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ron Harnack with the Red River Watershed Management Board and Watershed Districts, and Representative Green, if you wouldn't mind repeating that.
On the DE amendment, on line 5.27 and 5.28, it says the plan that's adopted by the county or watershed district must be consistent with the plan adopted by the board. And I'm just wondering how much leeway they have there.
Mr. Harnett.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, from a watershed district standpoint, watershed districts do not currently have APO authority. And I do not believe any of the watershed districts would use the APO authority under this provision to do any of the implementation if they assume jurisdiction. They would use their normal rulemaking and other enforcement procedures. They typically do not believe the fine is the way to get compliance. It's working with the landowner and providing that kind of assistance to get compliance, not using fines.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that, Mr. Harnack, but what I'm asking here is, let's suppose that the watershed district does adopt their own rules. And when I'm reading this, I just want a clarification. Can the board, and I assume this is the Bowser board, can they come in and say that's not good enough and then force them to do something else? That's my question.
Mr. Harnett.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, if a watershed district is going to assume jurisdiction, they have to put appropriate rules and enforcement procedures in place. Bowser would determine whether those were adequate for them to assume jurisdiction. They would not have to incorporate APO authority in order to achieve that.
Representative Green, thank you. Additional questions for Representative Parkelson. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's important, Representative Torkelson, you'd mentioned it during the initial discussion that the buffer law that passed last year significantly lessened the financial consequences with enforcement. That existing law was $10,000 and this is $500. And you're giving local units of government the ability to opt out. And Mr. Harnack just said they can opt out of the financial penalty. So I'm not sure what we're actually going to get at the end of all this. If local governments, I want to be real clear, local governments refuse to participate.
Representative Torkel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hansen. Bowser's APO authority has been in existence for, I believe, 13 years or so. They have never used it. They've never found themselves in a position where they needed to utilize it. This limitation, I think, is appropriate in that the whole effort here is to cooperate with landowners and work with landowners. It's not to figure out a way to penalize them. Financial penalties are not helpful in this arena, in my opinion, and I'd be happy to take comments from others if Mr. Harnack wants to add to mine.
Representative Torkelson, Director Jaski, I'm going to ask you just to come and sit there, too, because once in a while we may want Mr. Harnack, you can stay there. There's another chair. Representative Hansen, did you want Director Jaski to comment on that? I'm not sure if he heard it or if there was a point. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to follow up, the threat of financial penalty is an incentive as well. Is that correct, Mr. Jaski? Is that what, in Dakota County, the threat of going to court and having a financial penalty was what brought the last few people who refused to participate into compliance?
Director Jaski, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, John Jaski, Executive Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources. Representative Hansen's question, the current law that we have today, or the one we had actually before the law passed last year, required that either counties or watersheds had to adopt their own enforcement mechanisms. And so most of those were using the court system to deal with those last few problem cases in the case of the counties that you described. This would allow them, if they choose to, as Mr. Harnack said, use this this fine mechanism to, help that compliance happen. It's also true that the result that we're seeking is to get the buffer, the alternative practice, and the fine is sort of just a way to help that happen without having to go through a court to get it to that conclusion.
Director Jaski, I'm trying to remember, you came from Dakota County. Were you at Dakota County when we got full implementation of the current buffers in Dakota County?
Mr. Chairman, I was at Dakota County. We started it, but I had left before it was completed, but it's been completed as of today.
And Director Jaski, you probably know this, and I don't know the answer, but there was a few people that when we got towards the end in Dakota County, were any of them fined under current law where they could have been fined up to $10,000? Do you know, or maybe you can back to us?
Mr. Chairman, there was the use of Bowser's authority was never invoked in any of those situations. I don't believe that they actually ended up using a fine at all. I think they ended up getting compliance with the suggestion that a fine might come if compliance didn't happen. And so I believe they concluded that without having to prosecute, because that's the other option, which is to go to district court and file a case basically against an individual landowner from the county attorney's office. We wanted to avoid that because that's a very expensive and time-consuming effort.
And is the current situation that Representative Torkelson's in his bill, tell us how that would be better than what was happening then at that time.
Mr. Chairman, members, well, as this prescribes, you know, the local governments can either use their existing authorities, as Mr. Harnack mentioned, their rulemaking authority or ordinance authority, and they can enforce that with the mechanisms that are already in their own laws. They also have the option of adopting this $500 maximum APO authority if they want to use that instead of having to go to a court to enforce one of those other provisions. They will have the election to pick which one of those works the best. I will also tell you that in the counties that had done this, you know, systematically as you described, you know, they had 99% compliance. It was just the few that they needed to try and get to the end of full compliance, because otherwise the other 99% would wonder why they didn't, you know, work with everyone. So it's an optional tool. It's hopefully not going to be needed other than to get the buffer in, and that's what we think this is going to go.
Thank you. Representative Tarkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's important to clarify that it's my understanding that even if they take on the use of the APO authority, they still have the court action as an option. They are not giving that up. So there are other mechanisms available to local jurisdictions for enforcement besides the $500 APO authority.
Representative Hampson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you actually made the point, and which has been the fact, is that there always are a few people that you can't reach. And the fairness to the people who do it, or if whether we're talking individual landowners or local units of government. So if you have just a few landowners who refuse to participate, I think it's good to have a variety of tools with them, because you are going to have a few landowners who are going to refuse to participate. You're going to have the vast majority are going to participate. And the vast majority are probably going to receive some type of financial assistance. But the fairness to those folks and to the public who we're doing all this for the public water quality, for the folks who will drag their feet and fight the last minute not to put it in. And I expect there will be a few counties or watershed districts who will refuse to participate. So how the fairness is to make sure we have broad compliance. And how do we achieve that? So I think that's why we needed the law, because people didn't do it. You had a small number who were doing it, small number of local governments. I think you're going to get most of them. But my question on the bill, the whole thing today, is will this get us to the point where we will achieve, by the deadlines that are in there, compliance with the requirements?
Is there any comment by anybody?
Director Jaskie. I believe that it's attainable. And as was described by Representative Parkinson, you know, if the local governments don't do it, which I'm glad to hear that others also believe that we expect many of them will, because they've indicated that over the last several months, if they choose not to, then the state will have to. But we are hoping for maximum local government adoption of this program and execution of it.
Thank you. Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman, I think one really important thing to consider here, and it's been a pleasure working with Representative Torkelson and others on this, is if we are going to achieve good implementation of this, it's going to have to be done at the local level. If we expect to get all these buffers in by using the APO authority through Bowser, I think we got another thing coming. It isn't about fining people. It's about working together to get the buffers on the ground, working through local units of government. And I think local units of government will assume jurisdiction because they know they can do a better job of working with landowners than the state of Minnesota can.
Thank you, Mr. Harnack. Director Jaskie, I would strongly recommend that the testifier, and I'm not sure if you were here, from Candy, Ojai County, that testified and had that graphic photo of the two properties, and one caught a little bit of snowdrift off the field with no buffer on a drainage ditch, and immediately adjacent to it was the other field that had the 16 and a half foot buffer, and how it didn't have that snow coming over the top of it. The drainage ditch is really telling, and I've used it myself in some of my meetings, specifically yesterday with some Farm Bureau people both from Western Minnesota and Northern Minnesota, and they agreed that how they can be very effective. So the folks, I think there's some really good things out there happening on the land And I do think it's about people will do this. This will be good. Representative Torkelson, I really appreciate your approach and your due diligence on that and the clarification. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to Representative Hansen's comments, as I said originally when this the governor's plan was unveiled at the DNR roundtable, as it was in January of 15, somebody asked me for a comment, one of the media, and I said, well, if you think that you're going to take this plan into rural Minnesota, northwest Minnesota in particular, and jam it down people's throats, you're going to have a fight on your hands. And I think that Mr. Harnack explained it very well. We need to work with people. If you want to meet some of these deadlines, you're going to have to do it in a cooperative way. If you're going to try to jam stuff down people's throats, you are going to have a fight, and you're not going to meet deadlines. At that same roundtable in January of 15, I believe it was Jeff Broberg stood up, who I served with on LCCMR. He stood up and talked about the compliance that they had in the county that he worked in. And he was very proud of the fact that they had significant compliance there. And he said the way that they did that, it wasn't by threatening people. It wasn't by having administrative penalty orders. It wasn't by having the state there with a big hammer clubbing people over the head. It was by taking a thermos and a couple of coffee mugs and driving out to a farm and leaning over the hood of their pickup and having a conversation with somebody about, Mr. Harnack, what can we do to help you on your farm? You know, there's some programs out there available that's going to help to improve this stuff. And I think that what Representative Torkelson has done here with this bill and the DE amendment is recognize the fact that you can get a lot more done with a carrot than you can with a club, particularly in the part of the state that I represent. And to somehow suggest or imply that rural Minnesotans don't care about clean water and clean air and clean land, quite frankly, Representative Hansen, I find it difficult to accept. Now, we can go about this in a better way. The plan that was unveiled, and became law was flawed. There's no doubt about that. There was a significant outcry from all of rural Minnesota on a number of fronts. And one of the fronts that was there was the fact that private ditches and benefited areas, and that's being addressed here. I have a question of Director Jasky, Mr. Chair, if I may. Mr. Jasky, I asked you on a couple of occasions about the legislative intent of the previous bill that was passed in 15 and the impact on private ditches. Is there any doubt in your mind with regards to the language in this bill that private ditches are exempt?
Representative Fabian, can you clarify? You're talking about the DE3.
Yes, I am.
Director Jasky.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, no doubt.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for members in the audience and watching at home, I think what you just saw is the classic debate that we have at the Minnesota Legislature, making statements to statements that weren't said. And I want to be clear about that. Representative Fabian, Mr. Harnack, I think it was very clear in my language. With the experience that we've had in this state, and I said the vast majority of landowners will adopt this. But just like with any other law and any other enforcement, there will be people who refuse to obey the law. And to say that some people are special and don't have to obey the law, and to make the statement that that's an attack on all of rural Minnesota, Representative Fabian, I think you know better. Representative Harnack, I've worked with you, or Mr. Harnack, I've worked with you for a long time. I think you know better than that. The issue is there will be people who will not participate. And how do you get them into compliance? Existing law had not worked. And I think it's the rhetoric that we just heard that enables people to say, I don't have to participate. That I can come back to the legislature, Representative Torkelson, in the tax bill, try to make another change, or I can come back next year and make another change, and the year after that and make another change, and we'll keep tweaking this thing, because the loudest voices are not necessarily the majority. The few that don't participate or refuse to participate. And we can take this to any law that we pass in this body. People that refuse to follow the law. And we know, and we can have that debate on any topic, that there has to be some consequence for people who don't follow the law. I think a financial penalty is a tool, or, as I said in the earlier conversation, the threat of the financial penalty is a tool. So, Representative Fabian, I did not, and I think we can roll back the tape, make a statement on rural Minnesota, but every time we talk about how do we move this, we go back to the same old debates, the same old arguments, the same old assertions as we've had for 20 or 30 years, why we haven't been able to get stuff done. We need to get stuff done. And if this bill moves us forward, which, Representative Torkelson, I think it does, I don't want to be at the last minute of this session and we get a tax bill that has more stuff in it relating to buffers. And I think that this bill not having that helps us. But I think there's people in the audience that want more changes. People that will go out throughout Minnesota and say there needs to be changes on both sides. But the rhetoric doesn't do any good. How do we solve problems? You have to have a variety of tools to solve problems, because it's not fair for those landowners who participate voluntarily, who've participated already, and who participate in it, if there's two or three or four per county that refuse to participate. And that then they come here and will try to change law or raise ruckus, but they don't have to. Because the benefit here is to clean up our waters.
Representative Hauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did want to go back to Representative Hansen's earlier comment, and then he asked a question. And I listened, and I thought the two gentlemen didn't actually answer it. What I heard him say is, in Dakota County, the vast number did just that. They worked cooperatively, they did the right thing, and so forth. But that there were a few at the end, and then he said there was a tool then was able to be used. And what he was asking is, now he still thinks the vast majority will do just this. They'll work cooperatively, they'll do the right thing. But what tool do we have for those couple of them who aren't going to have that kind of spirit? That's, I think, what I heard him originally ask. And I listened, and I don't think I got the answer to that. We always assume there may be a couple of people, and how is it fair to everybody else if we don't have some tool for compliance? And I don't know if either of you have an answer to
Representative
that.
Hausman, the tool we have is the tool that Representative Fabian alluded to. Go out, have a chat with the folks, a conversation that now will happen with soil and water conservation districts. We'll go out there and chat with the landowner and say, you know, all your neighbors have complied with this. You haven't done it yet. And it might be grandma who says, you know what, I just get the rent from, you know, John Doe and didn't realize I was supposed to be doing this. And maybe you should talk to John and go over and chat with him. Or grandma says, no, I'd be willing to do it. I'll give John Doe a call and have him fix it. And they'll work it out. And or it's a landowner that, you know, is frustrated with he's had a bad year or whatever the situation is, or maybe he's going through some changes in his personal life, or she is, and different situations. But they'll reach out to them and get it worked out. There is the authority to slap them with a $500 fine. Used to be $10,000, which was never used, to our understanding, in 13 years. They now have this authority of $500, but that's not what we want to do. As Representative Hansen has said, most people will do it, and a few, I believe, for the most part, there'll be circumstances that, with what's going on the land, which is often the case, We need to work in a positive way, and I don't want this, I don't want anybody alluding to that we are changing what got passed last year. We are clarifying what passed last year. We have to get beyond anybody coming and testifying that we weakened or strengthened it, however you want to interpret those words. This was a clarification, and I would say a betterment, of what we did, so we have a better understanding. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I didn't think I was asking a hostile question.
It's not a hostile question.
Clarifying, and I do think, you know, if we lived in a Pollyanna world, absolutely everybody would respond to that cup of coffee, but we don't live in a Pollyanna world, and there are going to be a few who don't respond to the cup of coffee, and I just wondered if the two gentlemen thought if there are a few people who are perpetually cranky, what I heard Representative Hansen say in his county, most of them did, a few didn't, but you had a tool. And so all I was asking is, do the two gentlemen there who live in the real world know, do you still feel there is a tool for the non-cooperative people?
Representative Hausman, we'll let Director Jasky, but I am perennially, what was the adjective you used?
Cranky.
Cranky, yeah. But I still wouldn't hope to get to the point where I have to pay the $500 fine. Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Hausman, the answer is yes. And as the chair mentioned, this bill is clarification of the authorities that were passed last year in combination with authorities that already existed prior to the bill passing last year. And so that local level approach, which is, you know, one of the things that's not being changed in here at all is the fact that the soil and water conservation districts are going to be responsible for working with landowners to give them every option they can to put in whatever buffer practice or alternative practice works for that piece of property and give them options on design and financial assistance and so forth. So that's already going on, and we believe that will take care of the vast majority of every situation that's out there. I do want to emphasize this is a clarification package. It doesn't change what already was in the bill from last year, but they're helpful and important clarifications so that local governments who are going to be doing the work can have certainty about how to proceed. So, but with that, we do support this language because it does, in fact, accomplish that.
Thank you, Director Jasky. I think the only folks I have left to speak are the two ag groups, and I'd like you to come down together. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against House File 3000 as amended by the DE3? Okay, sir, we'll do you after the two ag groups. Folks, if you could identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and whoever goes first, the second one doesn't need a repeat, but the first one's out. Mr. Peterson, looks like you're ready to roll. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name's Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we support House File 3000 and the amendments that clarifies the clarifications. I think it's very important. It's a top priority for our members. We see, the maps are starting to come out. They're posted. Farmers are being able to look at them now and seeing what they're going to have to do. They're ready to move forward on this, and I think this will help clarify, you know, that we're working with the locals, where we know what the enforcement is, we know what the measurements are, though that we're talking about public waters, public ditches, not private. These are all things that they're appreciate in the clarifications. I think in the enforcement too, from what we've seen and talked to everybody, that, you know, the counties that are basically done, there was 80% compliance in the first year. I will say that it did take them, you know, from what I've understood, 5 years about on average to accomplish the whole thing. But in average, the first year, from what I've heard, they caught 80 and 90% the second year. And so there's good compliance. And I see that happening, that people are having those conversations. And so, but we are going to be asking them to do it in 2 or 3 years. And so I think we'll be fine. So again, appreciate working with Representative Torkelson and urge your support.
Thank you. Mr. Busselman, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Busselman, Minnesota Farm Bureau. We also support House File 3000 as well as the amended version. We think that the bill goes a long way in addressing the concerns that Minnesota property owners have had and clarifies the waterways that are needed to have the state mandate of buffers. The waterways of public waters and drainage ditches have gone through public processes to be classified as having the designations that they have. This is a much needed improvement in the legislation. Our policy supports local authorities enforcing the state buffer requirement and think that this bill improves that ability. We also think that the language relating to alternative practices is clarified and that the options available to provide landowners that option is spelled out more clearly and more effectively in this change. So we support the bill and encourage your support.
Thank you, Mr. Busselman. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Busselman and Mr. Peterson. One tool to get compliance is peer pressure. So I'd like to know what your organizations plan on doing for both promoting the law, but also dealing with if you have one or two members who refuse to participate, how peer pressure works and how it would be applied.
Mr. Busselman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, since the bill passed in the last special session, we've been involved in holding local meetings across the state. I've participated in over 70 meetings. The last couple of weeks, I've even had meetings with counties that are moving forward already with implementation process. Our encouragement to our members has been that we need to comply with the law and that these are the options that are needed. We talked about the options that they have as landowners. We believe firmly that if this is going to meet the deadlines that are spelled out here, it's not going to be because of government. It's going to be because of landowners taking the action that they need to take. And that's where our encouragement has been. And throughout those meetings and those messages, we have always maintained that it's important that we comply with the law.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, very similar. I don't think I've been to 70 meetings, but pretty close. The one thing I would just add to that is we've been really encouraging our members to get in and talk to their soil and water districts now. Even we've been doing this since the bill passed last year. And the ones that are getting in there, they're comfortable, but they're also asking about other practices. And I think the soil and water districts are doing a good job of saying, you know, the private waters is an issue for some people, and they're looking at some of the other parts on their property. Just getting them in the door and looking at some of those other practices has been helpful as well. And so I think it's a tremendous opportunity. The legislature, you folks gave them extra dollars to work on some other projects as well, and that's important as well. So we'll continue to promote compliance within our membership. And I think, you know, we're never not going to have 100%. Sometimes there's always going to be one or two people that are going to need, you know, some kind of hammer, but we're going to do our best. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no more questions for the two of you, thank you. Mr. Downing, if you could come forward. Oh, I'm sorry. You got to stay, both of you. Fabian. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say thanks to Mr. Busselman and Mr. Peterson. I know that you've put a lot of work into this, working with your members and your newsletters and your meetings and so forth, and I appreciate the good work that you're doing. I mean, you're in essence using an electronic cup of coffee once in a while and actually having those feet on the ground meetings, I'll say, all around the state of Minnesota. And I appreciate that, and I appreciate the work that many, many people have done on this bill. There's a lot of people in this room who've spent a considerable amount of time getting us to where we are. And just back for a second to Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen and I have worked together on some things. We agree and we disagree. I think but the main issue for me in this bill is, you know, we talk about compliance. I think what this bill does is it really moves the bar forward in terms of compliance, because we're actually going to be working with people. And we're going to get 60, 70, 80% compliance, 90% compliance. And I recognize that there may be a few holdouts. But if we had continued under the old bill and kind of the old plan as it was moving forward, we were going to be stuck in a very low level of compliance. So what we're getting here is a pretty doggone big bite out of the apple, and we probably got a small wedge left that we're going to have to work with at the end. And I would rather get a whole bunch, than to get not very much. And we can deal with those other people at the end. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both. Mr. Downing, if you want to come forward, if you could identify yourself for the record and give us your brief testimony. Thank you.
It will be brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Downing. I'm representing myself. I read and reread this bill, and I'm not speaking for or against. It's more for a point of clarification. If I understand this bill, and all the discussion I heard so far today is 100% rural agricultural issues. If I read this bill, it also applies to metropolitan recreational lakes. And am I incorrect in that assumption in reading the bill? Does it apply to all recreational lakes, including those of that are in Ramsey County, like White Bear Lake?
Mr. Downing, there's references to public waters, and public waters are affected by this bill, and White Bear Lake is a public water.
So at the present time, I just submitted a permit with the DNR to take care of the weeds and trees that are growing on my property on White Bear Lake that is perpendicular to the lake shore, the shoreline. Now I need to make sure I have a 50-foot buffer parallel to the shoreline also. Is that correct?
We're not changing current law, Mr. Downing.
I know, but I think if you were to ask lakeshore homeowners, does this bill or the previous bill from the 2015 session cover lakeshore property owners, I would say 99% of the people would not be aware of that. It would, that applies to lakeshore homeowners for recreational lakes. Now, I'm not asking that there be an exemption. I'm just asking that for future consideration, if the question is quality of the water, White Bear Lake is one of the highest quality water bodies in the state, and you may want to consider some exemption in the future for those types of lakes that already have a White Bear Lake Conservation District that has very high quality water already. But thank you very much for considering that. I'm not here to speak one way or the other. It's just a clarification. Now I know that I should communicate to all my neighbors that we have to comply to this bill as well.
Well, and Mr. Downing, I would suggest that you look at how it currently works on your lake. And some lakes have adopted, some counties have adopted actually broader restrictions or broader buffering requirements around their lakes and are continuing to work with people to do a higher quality buffer than a low quality one. Mr. Downing.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Seeing no questions. Anyone else to testify for or against this bill? I know there's a number of folks in the audience interested in the bill. Do any of you want to speak for or against the bill? Anybody else to speak for or against the bill? Representative Torkelson, you want to have the final comments? And
I do, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to reach this point in this process. It's been a long road. There's been quite a bit of conversation about compliance here today. I don't know of any law that we pass in this legislature that guarantees 100% compliance no matter what provisions we put in the law. People are people. But the goal is 100% compliance. We will do our best to incorporate that. We constructed this bill consist of counties that have been very successful in this effort. They did it without utilizing any $10,000 fines. And I believe that working with our SWCDs and the local water officials, we will have great success here. I think it's important to just remember the goal of this work is clean water. And that is what we're focused on, improving the waters of Minnesota. And Mr. Chair, I'm happy to present this bill for passage.
Well, and thank you, Representative Torkelson. What you've been through on this bill is second to none in my experience around here, and I commend you for weaving a path that seems unbelievable and to get to the point that you've brought it to. I truthfully believe in my heart that no one else in the Minnesota House of Representatives could have brought this bill in the way you did. So thank you for that work. Representative Torkelson renews his motion that House File 3000 as amended is passed on to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The bill's on to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. We have one more bill before us, Representative Johnson. I think we have your House File 2881. Representative Johnson, I think we're going to lay your bill over for inclusion in a future bill. Why don't you move your bill, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move my bill.
Representative Johnson moves House File 2881 to be laid over. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to present this bill. And House File 2881 supplements the cellulosic biofuels bill that this legislature passed in the last session. This bill, I think you'll soon find, has a significant value to the biofuels industry, has value to agriculture, and has value to clean water and the environment, and is supported by all three sectors. So I'd like to introduce Amanda Billick from the Great Plains Institute, who will work to share the details of the bill.
Welcome. Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Amanda Billick, and I work for the Great Plains Institute. I am here today representing the Bioeconomy Coalition of Minnesota. The Bioeconomy Coalition membership represents agriculture, forestry, and environment groups, as well as companies representing advanced biofuels, bio-based chemicals, utilities, law, and design engineering firms. A full list of our partners can be found in your packet. The Bioeconomy Coalition is pleased to support House File 2881. We view the Working Lands Watershed Restoration Proposal as a voluntary, market-based approach to source and supply biomass feedstocks, and it does not require agricultural producers to set land aside without a productive use. Although the program could be run similar to other conservation set-aside programs in terms of payments and administration, productive use of the biomass is central to the proposal. This could also be a new model for achieving environmental benefits while providing a productive use for perennial biomass and the land where it is grown. There are water quality and other environmental benefits that could be realized through this approach, and although it does not aim to implement a widespread approach to addressing water quality challenges, it is another tool that could be used to help move the needle in some selected watersheds, while also supporting the development of biomass processing facilities. So essentially, House File 2881 does two things. First, it establishes a program to provide incentives for agricultural producers to grow perennial crops for use in biomass processing facilities in no more than two watersheds and on a pilot basis. Second, it directs the Board of Soil and Water Resources to prepare a feasibility study and program plan to identify how to create and pilot the program. So with that broad overview in mind, I'll just walk through the key sections of the bill. In Section 1, in Subdivision 1, some key definitions to draw your attention to. The first is for a biomass processing facility. This would include facilities that would take perennial biomass and produce electric or thermal energy, renewable chemicals, or advanced biofuels. And perennial crops, these are crops that are agriculturally produced and are non-invasive and not listed as a noxious weed in Minnesota. Perennial crops have a life cycle of at least 3 years at the location where it's grown, and biomass from alfalfa produced on a two-year rotation is considered a perennial for the purposes of this program. In Subdivision 2, the program is established, which provides the incentives for the establishment and maintenance of perennial crops. It gives authority to the Board of Soil and Water Resources to contract with agriculture producers for the perennial establishment contracts. Subdivision 3 details the eligible land for the program. This is land that has been in agricultural use for crop production or land that has been set aside, enrolled, or diverted under another state or federal program for two of the last 5 years before the date of application. And it doesn't include land. Land that is currently under contract for a state or federal program is not eligible. Subdivision 4 outlines the voluntary contract terms. Landowner contracts must be in at least 10 years in duration, and the biomass grown would need to be supplied to a biomass processing facility. A portion can also be used for livestock feed, and this allowance for the use of livestock feed helps to serve as an intermediate step to scale up the feedstock establishment. And priority is given to areas that have potential to leverage federal funding, significant potential to leverage federal funding. Subdivision 5 details the pilot watershed selection. So this is where there's a maximum of two watersheds that would be selected under this program. And a watershed would need to have completed a watershed restoration and protection strategy, have access to a viable proposed biomass processing facility to process the perennial crops, and also have sufficient acres to establish the perennials needed. Section 2 details the requirements for a feasibility study and program plan, and this would need to be completed before the program could be implemented as described in Section 1. The feasibility study and program plan calls for 11 specific provisions that Bowser would look at to consider developing this program plan. Some of those specific requirements to be looked at is the process for selecting pilot watersheds that can achieve the greatest water improvements and exhibit readiness for the program participation. There's also assessments on agricultural land for the program, landowner interest, contract terms, and any recommended changes to the contract terms that are in Section 1. Opportunity to leverage federal funds and also state programs that could be complementary, an estimate of the water quality improvements, and integration with existing conservation requirements. The implementation timeline is to be coordinated with proposed biomass processing facilities, and a projection of sources is needed to complete the implementation plan, or to complete implementation of the program, excuse me. Bowser is directed to coordinate this assessment and the feasibility study and implementation plan with stakeholders and other key agencies, and then report back to the legislature by February 1st of 2018. There is a one-time appropriation of $479,000 associated to develop the feasibility study and program plan, and that covers the agency's costs for completing that study. So, that, Mr. Chairman, that completes the bill overview. In closing, I would add that the Bioeconomy Coalition of Minnesota supports this program and the feasibility study because we really see it as a complementary tool to supply perennial biomass feedstocks for future biomass processing facilities. This could include facilities that might take advantage of the advanced biofuel production incentive that was put in place last year, but is also broader to include biomass processing opportunities for thermal and electric energy, as well as bio-based chemicals. The proposal really focuses on matching up the biomass establishment with the potential processing facilities and getting the right mix of factors to line up that range from feedstock establishment, moving that feedstock to a facility, and then using the feedstock to produce a value-added product could result in significant environmental and economic benefits for Minnesota. We believe this proposal helps move us in that direction and has broad support from the agriculture, environment, and industry, as Representative Johnson indicated in his opening remarks. With that, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Member question?
We got time, my friend.
Are you sure? Representative Green, well, Representative Johnson, I just got a text message from my brother. He said, make sure you don't pass Clark's bill, so I don't know.
Mr. Chair, send him a thank you on that.
I do have a couple of questions on the bill. First of all, I recognize that the appropriation is for fiscal year 17. This might be for staff, but there's no date of enactment in the bill. Help me out.
Mr. Chair, so with the feasibility study is the piece that's looking to get funded for this year. It is the plan that once the program plan and feasibility study is completed, that would provide maybe more input on how the program would actually be implemented. And so feeling that the program plan and feasibility study would need to be completed before we would actually work to implement the program that's described in Section 1.
Ms. Taylor, can you shed some light on this for me?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members. If there isn't an effective date specified in the bill, there's some general ones that apply. And since this has an appropriation, it would be effective July 1st of this year.
That's kind of what I thought. And my second question kind of goes to the point that you were just making. You know, Section 1 of the bill is about the program itself, and Section 2 is about the feasibility study. And I guess I would be somewhat curious as to the appropriation. How is the appropriation divided between Section 1 and Section 2? Ms. Baylor.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the appropriation that's here is to apply, I think, as when we were had been discussing this, to apply for Section 2. I think that there could be some language that could be added to clarify that. To make that specific.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add that we did ask Bowser for a range of cost of the study. It was, I believe, $479,000 to $530,000. And you'll note that I chose to take the smaller figure. I just thought I'd make that clear.
Fiscal responsibility, I like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so this bill is being laid over, and maybe we can have some further discussions offline. But you know, one of the things I was going to suggest would be to do the feasibility study, and I see Bowser is here,
and I know Representative Green is anxious to get out of here. But the report is due by October 15th, or February 1st of 2018 and October 15th of 17. Can you give me clarification there? How you're going to get this done in that amount of time? Ms. Billick? Mr. Jasky? Director Jasky, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman and members, I believe there was a fiscal note that was requested and we responded to, and so the direct answer to your question, though, is that we would do a contract to get the work done, overseeing a contract with some experts that we would, you know, solicit through a bidding process like we do under the state of Minnesota contracting procedures.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, I'd like you to possibly consider, as we move this forward, you know, we're putting into statute Section 1 with this. The feasibility study might show us something completely different, that it's not feasible to do this. So I'm wondering if you would, at some point, maybe be willing to do the feasibility study during fiscal year, what are we coming, 17, and then circling back and putting Section 1 into statute in the next legislative session. It's just for discussion purposes. I know the bill is being laid over, but I think that, for me, it's a concern that I have.
Mr. Chair, I will consider that, but I want you to consider also that the plan was really considered part of the cellulosic biofuels bill that passed last year and was really an integral part to that. And we did not succeed in achieving that. And so advancing this forward, I think it belongs in the bill. So, but I will consider that.
Representative Clark.
Yeah, you said it. Seems like a lot of good partners working together here, Mr. Chair. I just had one question. I think if I read the bill right, the partner makes a 10-year commitment to the perennial crop. Is that right?
Mr. Chair.
President Clark.
Yes, it's a 10-year commitment.
Okay. And is that...
Representative Johns. Now, Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman. Is that... pretty acceptable to most of the folks, so I'm wondering, what is the usual kind of, I know we're doing something new, but does that seem like a usual amount of time that will draw a lot of people?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. That commitment has been part of the negotiations all along, and I want to be clear, we've been working together, you know, the three sectors have worked closely on this, and it has, that has value to assure some environmental issues, but also provides some assurance for the farming sector too.
Thank you. Clark?
Thank you. I'm just curious. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else, members? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question's been answered.
Thank you. Anything else? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment about the Section 1, Section 2. It does appear that Section 1 is not necessarily saying what the plan is going to be. It's a definition, and it kind of offers the opportunity with the watersheds and others. So I'm not sure, to your point, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that that Section 1 is actually defining and determining what the outcome is potentially going to be in Section 2. So... I understand what you're saying, but I'm thinking that maybe it's not exactly defining that, and so I just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Anything else, members? Okay. Anna Boroff is here on part of the Corn Growers Association, and Mr. Morris from the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. Would you come down and give your testimony? Proceed. You can fight over who goes first.
Okay. No, yeah, absolutely.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Anna Boroff with the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. On behalf of our 7,200 members, I'm here to support Representative Johnson's working lands bill, which would help look at establishing additional perennial crops on Minnesota farms. Perennial crops and cover crops are getting a lot of attention lately, it seems like, in the larger water quality conversation. But crops, as you all know, like alfalfa, aren't new to Minnesota farmers. But expanding and improving on the use of perennial cover crops is part of the many conservation practices that Minnesota farmers use makes sense to us. I want to be clear that perennial crops or cover crops might make sense on some farms, but not all, due to the diversity in Minnesota farms. Perennial crops are not the only solution, but another tool in a farmer's conservation toolbox that can help us all address water quality challenges and still grow the agricultural sector of our economy. We're trying to provide information and tools to farmers that help them strike that balance between a profitable farm operation and protecting our natural resources. This would be what I would describe as sustainability. Farmers are constantly evolving, changing their operations for the better, but they do need to manage their risk when trying new things. So whether it's planting more alfalfa or planting a new perennial crop, it needs to pencil out. This bill could make it help be a little more economically feasible to try some alternatives to traditional crops and create a market for it, especially at first when we're trying to get something like this started. So again, this is not the only solution to water quality challenges. If a perennial crop or a cover crop isn't feasible, Minnesota Corn wants to help farmers identify alternative conservation practices to achieve similar outcomes. We invest about $4 million annually of farmers' money to do those sorts of things and to improve on the many conservation practices available to protect our state's waterways and improve productivity. I think Representative Johnson shares our view that highly productive agriculture and clean water are not mutually exclusive, and we appreciate his willingness to work with us on this bill. It is our farmers who will be the ones that will take a lot of the responsibility for the putting the steps on the ground towards continued water quality improvement. We'd like to support your ideas and work with policymakers to move forward on that issue. So, thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of our farmers. Thank you to Representative Johnson for his honest conversations with our farmer leaders the last couple of months, the opportunity to be part of this diverse coalition, and the Great Plains Institute for bringing us together. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Boroff. You mentioned the balance between profitable farm operation and conservation.
Yeah.
With the price of corn right now, I'm not sure we have that balance, but we'll keep working on that.
Thank
Mr.
you,
Morris,
Chair.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Morris. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, the state's largest coalition of environmental conservation groups. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to kind of quote you from the last bill. The goal of this work is also clean water. But it's also clean water and productive farmland, as Ms. Boroff just said. It builds on the 2015 Advanced Biofuels Incentive Legislation. And what it does is it recognizes that in order to address our water quality issues, it's clear we have to put some additional crops and add some cover and perennial crops into the mix, into the landscape. So what this does is this really charts a new course, and you've heard this a little bit, between the regulatory practices and the infield practices and the taking land out of production and just setting it aside. We should think about these perennial crops as really conservation crops. So they're working lands that will provide a lot of conservation while still providing productivity for agriculture. And the other thing that's unique about this bill is it really targets these conservation crops to the water cleanup plans that we've been aggressively been developing around the state over the last 4, 5, 6 years as part of the legacy funding. So we figure out where we need the most work in terms of water quality, and then we target these conservation crops to those lands. The big key, of course, is it's really going after that market. So how can we have these conservation lands and target them and situate that these lands where they'll be do the most good for water quality and conservation, but also be set up for a good market. And it's really to jumpstart that market by either biomass or even for livestock that we're really looking at. So this is a it's a win-win approach. It's different than what we've done in the past. And to your question, your comment, Mr. Chairman, about the Section 1 and Section 2, the idea is to actually put the reason we have it set up this way is to put the program into statute, because the conversations about expansion of advanced biofuels and other types of biomass industries are already occurring. So we really want to send a strong message that after the bill last year, the state's really serious about figuring out how we can actually make that bill work on the ground. We have the more than the bones, we really have the pieces of the program in place. The actual implementation will not be funded, however, until we do the detailed analysis and then come back. If there need to be some refinements, we can do that. But it really sends a strong message to the private sector that we as a state are serious about figuring out how to make this work. And that's part of the reason we want it in the law, so we can point to that and say we have a process going. We're figuring out how we're actually going to implement this, but we have a commitment to moving ahead with this new type of working lands, conservation type crops. And with that, I'd just like to thank Representative Johnson for helping to pull all the parties together and the other various supporters of this bill, because it is something that really has broad coalitional support.
Thank you. Representative Pop.
I don't have a question, just a comment. This
proceed.
Is appropriate, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Well, I just want to commend everybody who's at the table, and certainly Representative Johnson. He took a challenge on and determined that he wanted to bring the parties together, and it's just very exciting. And I know, Ms. Boroff, you spent a great deal of time as well on this, and I know others, Ms. Billick, Mr. Morris, you know, others are certainly engaged in this conversation, but Representative Johnson saw that there was still some need to kind of clarify and do some more things. So much like the buffer bill and much like the advancement of that, you know, we do have a good advanced biofuels bill that we passed, and now this is something that helps to really move that forward. So I just want to commend everyone and thank you for your time and your effort. Thanks, Representative Johnson, for taking this on and for everyone to be engaged in this. It's just, to me, it's always good when you see environmentalists and agriculture specialists and people together at the table and coming up with the solutions, and I appreciate that you all are doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Poppy. Representative Johnson, I do have one more question, and maybe Mr. Jaski needs to be on board here as well. On page 2 of the bill, it talks of 2.6 through 2.9. It talks about contract terms, use as livestock feed and so forth. On line 2.8 and 2.9, it says the board, which I believe is Bowser, may make additional payments to assist with the establishment of perennial crops. So I'm curious to know Bowser's position on that, and if they are making payments to assist with additional establishment of perennial crops, is that coming from the 479, or is that something that is coming out of Bowser's budget? Mr. Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, members, the way I understand this is that the appropriation, if one is to be forthcoming for this piece of legislation, would have us do the feasibility study and complete that, and then once a program was created and funded, then this would be the provisions that would be carried out with that subsequent funding.
So, to both of you, that's something that would have to be addressed by future legislative bodies?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Any other questions, members? With that, renew the motion to lay this bill over. The bill's laid over. Anything else before the committee? If not, we're adjourned. Thank you, members.